Hello, and welcome to Small Town Mysteries, a show where three longtime friends from Massachusetts tell crazy and heartbreaking true stories filled with the extra flair of small town mystery. I'm Kate, here with Christine.
Hello.
And Rachel.
Hello.
Bringing you our next episode on the three-decade murder mystery of Kathy Sposito. But before I get into that, I'm going to toss it over to Rachel, who is covering our missing person for this week.
Weech. Thank you so much, Kate.
Weech. I said weech.
Okay, so she definitely just said that because before we started recording, she called me a wench. So it's still stuck in her mind.
No. I was trying to say weak, and then I was thinking how I always go, Rach, like with a question mark at the end when I hand it over to you. And I went, weech.
Do you remember when you just forgot to introduce me?
I do. I have every single episode since then made very special care to not leave anyone out. Okay, go ahead.
Today I'm going to be covering Lucky Jones Daniels, who was last seen on February 12, 2024 in Baltimore, Maryland. She is 12 years old and a female, and that's all the information. If you have any information, any tips, please contact Baltimore Police Department in Maryland at 1-410-396-2455. And we'll be posting a picture of her on our Instagram at Small Town Mysteries Pod. So you can check that out there.
Okay. So for today's episode, I decided to pick a case that is resolved. I feel like we've had a lot of unsolved cases lately. And I was like, hey, how about we do something that's been solved? It's mostly solved. You'll see what I mean as we get into it. I would say it's solved, but not resolved, to nitpick on language a bit there. But this case is really an excellent example of what can happen when dedicated investigators and a loving community come together to solve a crime. So that was another reason why I chose this. With careful preservation of evidence and orchestrated volunteer efforts, the killer of Kathy Sposito was identified 36 years after her horrifying death.
Oh my gosh.
So for the details. On June 13th, 1987, Catherine Sposito, or Kathy as she was known to her loved ones, was hiking along Thumb Butte Trail in Prescott, Arizona. I will say that every time I was writing this, I said Thumb Butt Trail, and then I looked it up. So that's me doing my part to share accurate information. Just 23 years old, Kathy was a college student who often rode her bike to the trailhead and hiked along the path that was known among the community for being very safe. That morning, Kathy was attacked suddenly and unprovoked by an unknown assailant during her hike. For what it's worth, there were others close by enough to hear her screaming. But in the short time it took them to reach Kathy, she was already dead, covered in blood on the hiking trail known for its peacefulness.
It's terrible.
Kathy had been hit with both a rock and a wrench, but her attacker did not stop there. She was then shot in the eye and stabbed in the head before her killer fled the trail.
All in this trail where people were close by?
And yeah.
What, you just bring a bag filled with different stuff? Like, what?
I don't know if this guy had, like, a murder kit or what, but the rock presumably came from the trail.
Well, the rock makes sense, okay? But the wrench and then a gun and a knife.
Yeah.
Did this person know Kathy? Like, that seems like such overkill for someone who might not have been emotionally, like, mm-hmm. attached to her.
Yeah.
So I agree. That was my first thought, was this was like, oh, this is overkill. This is personal. I don't think it was. I don't think they knew each other at all. I think it was a completely random attack. And there's plenty of reason for me to believe that as we go through this, it'll become pretty clear that this was just some guy and he took advantage of the opportunity.
I feel like, I don't know him per se, but there's some killers that just hate women.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So you see the opportunity and you take it.
Right. I do think this seems like a crime of opportunity. So the search for Kathy's killer almost immediately went cold. A few years after Kathy's murder, another woman who was on a camping trip with her boyfriend was sexually assaulted by an unseen attacker at around the same time of day that Kathy had died and on the same trail.
Holy crap. So if that's the same person, could you imagine, I don't know, like being the person that was attacked being like, he attacked and killed. That could have been me. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think that just like screws with my mind to think about
I don't think it's insignificant that she was with her boyfriend on the trip too. I don't think that is, you know, like, I feel like that's relevant.
The ego that this person had mm-hmm. to commit the crime at like around the same time of day in the same area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's.
And it wasn't even like, it was 3 years later.
Mm.
But I'll get into that in a bit because there's plenty of reason to believe that he committed several other crimes in those 3 years, possibly in that same area that he has not been definitively linked to. Of course, DNA evidence was collected from both crime scenes, but in 1987 and 1990, respectively, the technology had not caught up to a point where such evidence was able to provide much assistance at all in the investigation. So Kathy's murder was actually solved backwards, in a way. The Yavapai County Sheriff's Office, I think I'm saying that correctly, which handled the investigations for both the sexual assault on the trail and Kathy's murder, has a cold case division that is staffed by very dedicated volunteers. Normally, I don't always have such kind things to say about so-called armchair detectives, but in a formal setting, with the blessing and assistance of the sheriff's office and with the appropriate evidence in hand, amateurs can make breakthroughs by doing some grunt work. And sure enough, they actually solved 4 cases at once.
Wow.
That's yeah, this crazy. All kind of tumbled down and just 4 cases, boom, 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 which is incredible.
I mean, it's honestly not a bad idea. Like, people are smart.
Right. I think part of the reason for my disdain for, like, armchair detectives is, and we've talked about this so many times before because it comes up all the time, but when people don't have, like, access to appropriate evidence and they're just, like, making conjectures that are not based in fact. These people, you know, they're provided with the evidence. They have the support of a trained homicide detective. Like, it's a very different situation in my eyes. And I really commend them for the work that they do, because sometimes you need many hands to make light work. And that is exactly, this is a great example of the more people to go through the mountains of evidence, the more likely you are to find that one thing that can be really, really important in solving a case.
Right. It only makes sense. Like, sometimes it just takes one person to look at something differently or think mm-hmm. of something that everyone else didn't think of.
Exactly. So in 2020, the Volunteer Cold Case Unit began looking into the 1990 sexual assault that had occurred on the Thumb Butte Trail because science had finally caught up to the DNA evidence. Of course, DNA evidence was much more accessible in 2020 than it was when these crimes occurred, and further developments, such as familial DNA, ultimately led to the break in these cases. So we've talked a lot about familial DNA on this podcast, and it definitely is something that I feel like, if you follow true crime news, comes up a lot as well. So, like, totally hypothetical example, someone mails a tube of their spit to Ancestry or 23andMe to find out their heritage. It turns out their uncle murdered someone, but without the uncle's DNA, they weren't able to make a match, so he got away with it. And then there were substantially similar markers to identify the uncle as the perpetrator based on the niece's DNA. So that's how familial DNA in general works. It's a little convoluted. These cases pop up all over the place now, especially as these DNA websites become more and more popular among white people who want to know exactly what variety of white they are. That's a running joke in my family. I actually have literally right in front of me right now an Ancestry DNA kit that I have not sent in yet because I keep forgetting. But we joked that we sent it off to find out what variety of white we are because it's European.
So, Kate, yes. From like a legal standpoint, they're allowed to do that. So you're signing off, like you're just giving away your DNA.
Yeah. And so basically she gives her own DNA. The fact that science can connect it to someone else. Yeah. I mean,
you click something when you.
There's like a box when you click that's like, do whatever.
That essentially say that. I don't know if you can deny it. I think you could when I submitted mine, but that was years ago, so probably not now.
So if you think anyone in your family has a skeleton in their closet, maybe don't go for the Ancestry DNA kit.
Or maybe do, depending on your feelings.
Yeah, if you don't like them.
You know.
I've definitely seen cases of people who like specifically suspected something and used this like as leverage to like get answers because they suspected a family member. So In this case, the DNA from the sexual assault case was determined to belong to one of two brothers that they were able to find, that the sample they had was one of two brothers, but they weren't sure which one, both of whom had lived in the area at the time of both crimes. One of the brothers, Brian Scott Bennett, had been linked to other crimes in the years since the murder and sexual assault, so they turned their attention toward him. Without a definitive sample of Brian's DNA, they couldn't make a 100% identification connecting him to these cases. And fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you view the situation, Brian was dead. So it's not like they could subpoena a DNA sample from him. He had committed suicide in 1994 in Kentucky after moving away from Arizona. To exhume a body, you need to have probable cause. You have to be able to prove that sufficient evidence shows that exhuming the body will yield necessary evidence to further the case. It's not the most unattainable barrier, but exhuming a body is a process that requires a lot of people and a lot of manpower, and it's not always feasible to do. So Rich Finston, a volunteer with the Cold Case Unit, worked on Kathy Esposito's murder for 12 years as a volunteer. It was the first case he was ever assigned. He explained a really good reason why this case went unsolved for so long, even after the advent of DNA evidence that would be beneficial, was because of the rotating cast of characters who shifted through the sheriff's office over time. He said, quote, "When continuity gets lost, things fall into cracks. And so we kind of find cracks and try to fill them," which I think is a really excellent explanation of why it's so beneficial to have a volunteer unit like this. As a small agency, the Yavapai County Sheriff's Office is often understaffed and overworked, so their cold case unit is an invaluable asset for solving these older crimes. They have six or so volunteers overseen by a trained homicide detective, so they're able to find the small pieces of evidence that might otherwise be overlooked, which sometimes helps them solve the case. So investigators were able to leverage the familial DNA connection that they had uncovered, and Brian's body was exhumed for DNA testing, which finally confirmed once and for all that he had killed Kathy Esposito. His DNA had been recovered from the wrench that he had used to beat Kathy on that fateful morning. As I said, Brian Scott Bennett died just 6 years after Kathy's murder, when he committed suicide using a .22 caliber pistol. Eerily enough, Kathy herself had been attacked with a .22 caliber pistol, but the evidence is not sufficient enough to demonstrate that the same pistol was used in both instances. Brian Scott Bennett was also connected to several other assaults, including an attempted sexual assault at a party just 2 months after Kathy's murder, and an assault on a woman at the Prescott Post Office in 1993. He moved to Kentucky just months later and died not long after, never having faced criminal charges for any of these crimes.
That's horrific.
I agree.
Also, it puzzles me too, because he just committed one murder and just sexually assaulted. Especially with something like that, I don't believe it.
I'm getting to it.
The way that he murdered her.
I'm getting to it.
Okay.
Yeah, you're right to feel suspicious about this. Perhaps the most baffling piece of this puzzle is that Brian Scott Bennett was only 16 years old. Literally a junior in high school when he viciously attacked and murdered Kathy Esposito.
What the fuck?
Yeah. So he was in high school. Investigators believe that at his young age at the time of this offense, and the several subsequent offenses that followed rather quickly, it's almost certain that Kathy was his first murder but not his last, especially due to the intensity and frequency of his attacks. It is entirely possible that Brian Scott Bennett could be connected to several other unsolved murders in the Prescott area between 1987 and 1993. I hope that those families are able to find justice as Kathy's family did. When Sheriff David Rhodes announced on August 25th, 2023, that his office was almost certain that Brian had murdered Kathy Esposito, watching with bated breath was Renee Sandoval, the woman Brian had sexually assaulted on the Thumb Butte Trail in 1990. Just 22 years old when she was attacked, Renee said that the identification was, quote, a long time coming. She also said that she felt relief for Kathy and her family, stating that Kathy was finally free. So, yes, this case is solved. We know who killed Kathy Esposito, but he's dead. He'll never face justice for what he did to her, to Renee Sandoval, to his other two known victims, and however many unknown victims there are. But there is still a chance to bring closure to these victims, even though they are, as of yet, unidentified. So the sheriff's office asks that anyone with information about Brian Scott Bennett and potential other crimes he may have been involved in contact the Yavapai County Sheriff's Office at 928-771-3260. And that was a little quick hitter for you guys, but that is my case.
Yeah, I feel like obviously 35 years later,
36
years later.
Yeah.
It's not shocking. Mm-hmm. Sadly, that the person is dead. I guess it is a little considering he was 16 years old at the time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's incredibly frustrating. I'm also sure that some of her family died before they mm-hmm. could get that justice for her, get that at least answer. Mm-hmm. So that's also incredibly frustrating.
That was a difficult part of my research, was I kept looking for information on her family and her family's reaction mm-hmm. to the news, and I couldn't find anything. And I also yeah. couldn't find a ton of information on her, just that she was a college student, that she had ridden her bike to the trail, and that she did that sometimes, you know, that like mm-hmm. she liked that area, and that was kind of all I was able to get on her. To be fair, there wasn't a ton on the suspect either, except for the fact that he was 16 and then died. Like, it was pretty bare bones in that regard. But I do think the thrust of this case is in the fact that a volunteer department solved it.
Right.
And I do think that's incredible that they were able to peek through this evidence, find that one little thing. I mean, needle in a haystack. So in one of my English classes, we learned about, I think I've talked about this before, but I'm going to mention it again because it is really relevant here. We talk about cats and pigs. So it's literally like if you draw a cat, it's a circle with two ears on top, like elementary level, kindergarten level drawing. But when you want to make that into a pig, you just add a squiggly tail and then it's a pig. So in analyzing literature, which was the application in which I learned this, the point was to notice the cats and be able to pull out the pigs. So like you need to know what the pattern is to identify the variations that are significant. So like we used it in analyzing Shakespeare, and it was like in Shakespeare, when you notice that he always writes things a very specific way or characterizes things a specific way, and then he doesn't, or he does something slightly different, that's always notable. And it always has deeper meaning than you realize. I think that this applies generally to everything. And really that lesson, I think about it almost every single day. People would say the needle in the haystack is like a similar metaphor. You have to look for the needle in the haystack. This is the framework for how to find the needle within the haystack, you know? And I think this is a really good example of people who sifted through so many cats to find the pig. So that's my long-winded explanation of absolutely nothing relevant to this case that I still view as my framework for like investigative studies and research. So yeah, that's my case. 36 years. Incredible.
It's a long time.
Yeah.
Also impactful, I felt, to have the testimony, well, not the testimony, but the other victim able to comment mm-hmm. after all these years.
I think that's really powerful.
That was very powerful. And for her to also know, like, and say, like, this is for Kathy just as much as it is closure for me. I thought that was really beautiful.
It's, like, mm-hmm. sad to think the past month or so, or the past couple months, I feel like we've covered a lot of cases, or at least several, in which it's been a long time and the person mm-hmm. is dead, or, you know, something happened to them before mm-hmm. they could pay for their crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think it's sad, too, that you couldn't find a lot of information. And we've talked about this, but part of that is probably just because it was so long ago. And sadly, mm-hmm. information about people dies with people that loved them.
That's true.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I tried to keep this a little optimistic, even even though it's kind of a bummer of a case to, you know, have closure, but not really closure. I was trying to keep it a little not in the doldrums like that. But so on that note, I'm going to wrap this up. This was a little quick episode for ya. We are accessible on Instagram at Small Town Mysteries Pod. We will also have information there about the missing person highlighted in this episode. So if you live in that area, please check that out. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts if you like what you're listening to. We'd love to hear from you. feel free to DM us if you live in a small town, live near a small town, wish you lived in a small town, or have heard of a small town where weird things happened. We just might cover it. We're going through our backlog of listener suggestions right now. Today was not a listener suggestion, but in general, we are doing a lot of those. So reach out to us. We'd love to hear from you and hear about your weird small town.
Hey.
So, yeah, I will see you guys next week for another another little case.
Sparrow with us next week.
Bye.